Despite a growing number of protests happening around the world, most Americans still prefer legislation over revolution.
The people who have been engaged in the American resistance very much believe in working with the system, and the organizations that have been channeling all this energy and enthusiasm certainly believe in this system of democracy that we have here.
I'm Arun Vanigopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 10th, we'll look into these global protests and why they aren't really catching on in the U.S. Plus, we'll break down the controversy surrounding Gayle King, who got herself into some hot water with black celebrities by raising questions about Kobe Bryant's sexual assault charges.
It's been said that his legacy is complicated because of the sexual assault charge, which was dismissed in 2003, 2004. Is it complicated for you?
Big conversations plus your takes. Let's get to it. In April of 2019, people in Sudan took to the streets, leading a movement that deposed a dictator who had ruled for 30 years. In October, what began as a protest against subway fare hikes led to a nationwide movement in Chile that continues to this day. And in France, protesters continue to actively clash with police in demonstrations against proposed changes to the country's pension system. But here in the U.S., social movements have looked a little bit different. In the past few years, we've seen the rise of various protest movements, including the Women's March, the Climate March, and Black Lives Matter. After President Trump's acquittal on Wednesday, people in a number of cities took to the streets, including here in New York. But none of the efforts here have quite reached the same boiling point as other mass movements around the globe. So at this moment, when our country is so polarized, we wanted to take a pulse check on social movements here at home. I'm Arun Vanigopal, and today on The Takeaway, the state of the so-called American resistance and how it compares with movements around the world. Dana R. Fisher is with me to talk through this. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the author of American Resistance, From the Women's March to the Blue Wave. Thanks for joining us, Dana.
Thank you for having me, Arun.
And we're also joined by George Ciccarello Marr, a visiting scholar at the Decolonizing Humanities Project at the College of William & Mary. George, thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
Dana, your book is called American Resistance. How would you characterize the state of the American resistance?
It's hanging in there, but I think that it's been a long march to 2020, and many of the people got active originally marching in the streets, and then they transferred their outrage, energy, and enthusiasm into doing so many more activities around electoral politics through the midterm elections. We see them continuing to do a lot of work around electoral politics, activism. We've seen lots of small-scale, diffuse protests taking part around impeachment recently. And I think people are starting to feel the wear and tear of being so engaged for so long. At the same time, it's alive and well and definitely setting its sights on the 2020 election.
One thing you wrote in an article at Time magazine is that for the most part, Americans believe in working with the system, correct?
Definitely. The people who have been engaged in the American resistance very much believe in working with the system. And the organizations that have been channeling all this energy and enthusiasm into working around electoral politics certainly believe in this system of democracy that we have here.
George, how does what's happening in America compare to what you're seeing around the world with these various international movements popping up in various countries?
Well, I think we should recognize that we live in a moment globally of resistance, of radical movements in the streets. And many of these are responding to some of the same dynamics, right? Neoliberal economic reforms, a declining quality of life as the rich get richer and the poor get poorer in so many different ways in so many different parts of the world. Now, how people respond to that, I think, depends depends on local conditions, on local histories and traditions of struggle. One of the things that we, of course, do notice is that those traditions in the United States are often much more muted, which is not to say that they don't exist. But, of course, the sorts of protests that we see breaking out, even in Western Europe, but certainly in Latin America and other parts of the world, tend to be much more willing to be outside of an anti-systemic. They tend to prioritize street struggles and understand that what happens in the halls of power is a reaction to that and a reflection of that power that they can generate in the streets. And that's, again, not always, but something that is often lacking in the United States.
So is this the case both with countries that are more democratic as well as ones that are less so?
Oh, absolutely. So, for example, even in Western Europe, if you look at places like Italy and Spain, these are places that can draw upon a long tradition of direct action struggles and resistance to fascism, for example, to fuel struggles that seek to engage with the democratic system, but to do so with the recognition that the power really lay in the streets. Or in Latin America, where street protests in the past few decades have actually fueled things like constitutional reforms and redrafting of more left-wing constitutions. And so there's an engagement with these systems, but an understanding that in order to do that, a system is not going to change itself voluntarily, often from within.
Dana, is there something that maintains Americans' respect for the system?
Well, I would say that the basic reason why we see so much activism targeting institutional power here in the United States is because the people who are participating in this resistance in the streets actually have this sense that they could be effective by targeting and working through the institutional system. What we've seen in the United States is during periods where people who are protesting no longer feel like they have any capacity to actually make change through the political system is when you see more disruptive activism and people working outside the system.
And has this historically been the case? I mean, how does that compare to, say, earlier periods of oppositional movements, say the civil rights movement or the Vietnam War?
Well, during those periods of activism, we had these intensified periods of confrontation, which we have now. But in those periods of time, particularly well documented is the ways that the civil rights movement became increasingly confrontational over time. And we saw a lot of confrontation around with the movement against the war in Vietnam. And in both of those cases, it was at the point at which people started to realize that they couldn't change things from within. Now, right now, the resistance is continuing to use this framing that is, it's all about the election. And you can see that not just with people who are in power, but also the organizations that traditionally help channel people who are engaging in activism to see what kind of tactics they take. And so far, they're taking really peaceful tactics. Even when they protest, it's legally permitted. It involves the required porta potties. And, people come out after work hours or they come out on Saturdays. It's not about a general strike that's involving shutting down any type of system, at least not yet.
What do you see as the most successful? Are there particular protests that you see as among the most successful examples of resistance here in the U.S.?
Well, I think that the way that the American resistance has been using protest is first as an opportunity for collective identity formation. That is, people go out in the streets and they find that they're not alone. People have spoken about the Women's March 2017, which was the largest day of protests in U.S. history, as being this sense of kind of collective outrage and group therapy. My research team and I were out in the streets surveying protesters here in Washington, D.C. We surveyed a random sample of 528 people who were in the streets and asked them why they were out there. And it ran the gamut in terms of progressive issues, but people were out there to feel like they weren't alone anymore. What was interesting about it is it became the beginning of people's activism. A third of the people who came out to the Women's March 2017 had no previous experience with politics or activism. But as I track them through the book, I talk about this, I track them through the midterm elections. And we find that people come out again and again to protest in the streets, and then they do so much more around their congressional districts and in their communities around politics and the midterm elections. The outrage was channeled into these kinds of specific electoral political goals. And we saw it with the blue wave during the 2018 election.
George, when we think about 4 million people gathering in protests across the country on a single day in America, that's quite an impressive figure. But then when we look at Hong Kong, where the reports indicate that there were 1 million people on certain days of a population of, I think it's around 7 million. This is, I guess, a a fraction of the population that is quite extraordinary. And I'm wondering what you make of that and how it's possible for a population to turn out in that kind of show of force.
Right. And again, this speaks to very different contexts and very different questions. But at the same time, numbers are not everything. Some of the most dramatic transformations in U.S. history have not come from the biggest numbers. And often it's very difficult to track the impact of smaller protests that do play large roles, either by mobilizing people, as was mentioned, or by actually creating these shockwaves in American society. So if you think about moments like the uprising in Ferguson and in Baltimore that helped to sort of catapult Black Lives Matter onto the national agenda, the numbers did not, you know, they were not particularly impressive numbers, but symbolically and politically, the impact of these protests could not be overstated. And they really forced the agenda to come to terms with something that had been silenced and that had been pushed off the collective political radar.
Has the U.S., in terms of the political and corporate establishment, historically been successful at keeping certain people from joining mass movements?
I think we should understand that the U.S. political system was not set up to mobilize people. It was set up to largely demobilize people in favor of something like stability. So the Supreme Court, the role of the Senate and others. And we've also seen that play out in history when movements get too strong. We shouldn't carry through this program without mentioning just the brute repression of the civil rights movement, the harassment of Dr. King, the targeted assassinations directed toward the Black Panther Party, and harassment by the FBI's COINTELPRO program, which speaks to what happens when these movements, I think, are seen as too radical, even when we may look back and say the demands were actually very straightforward and not radical at all. And so we see this over and over again, and this plays a huge role in demobilizing people. It doesn't permanently demobilize them. Of course, it certainly didn't silence those struggling for racial justice who were often on the front lines of U.S. protest movements. And so, of course, again, Ferguson and Baltimore, Black Lives Matter, surging forth as key movements in our time. But it makes it difficult to, on the one hand, create a unity among different kind of movements that experience very different levels of repression. And it operates as a barrier to people thinking that they can actually intervene on the streets and create a change, even if that's really the only thing that's ever created significant change.
Dana, there's a quote in your article at Time magazine. History shows us that when activism gets more disruptive and confrontational, institutional power responds.
Basically, this question of violence usually is not sparked by people who go to the streets to be violent. Sometimes that happens. Most of the time, the initial intention is to be peaceful and disobedient, right? So you sit down in the middle of a street, you know, you refuse to move to the back of the bus. And then when confrontation turns violent is when there are repressive tactics taken by institutional power, in most cases the police. But what happens when people continue doing it is not only do the people who are protesting get more confrontational and more in institutional power's face with the hope of pushing for change, but those who are trying to get us back to a stable period without confrontation, those people also are going to push back harder.
Dana R. Fisher, a professor of sociology at the University of Maryland and the author of American Resistance, From the Women's March to the Blue Wave, and George Ciccarello Marr, a visiting scholar at the Decolonizing Humanities Project at the College of William & Mary. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
We asked you if you've ever protested and what it meant to you. Here's what a few of you had to say.
Hi, this is Susan McCabe from Vashon, Washington. I have marched for women's rights and I have marched for Black Lives Matter. I am not convinced that these movements truly move the people who are currently in power. In fact, these demonstrations are often ignored by legislators and the administration. I do think mass demonstrations can affect voters.
Hi, this is Laura from San Rafael, California. I've marched for women's rights and health care, and I will continue to march. I think showing up is part of the change, and once we stop showing up, we give up our power.
I traveled to Washington, D.C. to protest the Vietnam War. When something is clearly wrong and immoral, I feel it's my duty as a human being to protest. Scott Siegel, Evanston, Illinois.
This is Irene from Valley Stream, New York. I went on my first protest in 2003 during the lead up to the war in Iraq. And as I marched in New York City, and there were just thousands and thousands of people marching, And there were sister marches in London and Paris and Los Angeles and San Francisco. I was hopeful. I thought we could maybe stop a war. But since then, I've kept marching because silence implies consent.
My name is Mark, calling from Trumbull, Connecticut. Growing up in South Africa, I protested against apartheid. Did it really make a difference? Well, eventually, but only as a small part of a much larger protest, which unfortunately involved much violence and killing by anti-apartheid forces.
877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. It's The Takeaway.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
Last week, CBS This Morning co-host Gail King interviewed WNBA star Lisa Leslie about the legacy of Kobe Bryant. In the conversation, she asked Leslie about the controversy over the rape accusations that were made against Bryant in 2003.
Is it even a fair question to talk about it, considering he's no longer with us and that it was resolved? Or is it really part of his history?
I think that the media should be more respectful. At this time, it's like if you had questions about it, you've had many years to ask him that. I don't think it's something that we should keep hanging over his legacy. I mean, it went to trial.
Yeah, it was dismissed because the victim in the case refused to testify.
When CBS released a clip of the interview, the backlash was swift and fierce. Many took aim at Gail King for raising the rape allegations against Bryant at all, while others leapt to her defense. One celebrity who took to social media to express his anger was Snoop Dogg.
We expect more from you, Gail. Don't you hang out with Oprah? Why are y'all attacking us? We your people.
We aren't going to play the rest of that clip because it gets vulgar and threatening. But Snoop's message plays into a long-standing debate about expectations of black women, including journalists, to defend and uphold black men at all costs. To help us break all of this down, I'm joined by Dream Hampton, a filmmaker, activist, and executive producer of the docuseries Surviving R. Kelly, Soraya Nadia McDonald, a culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated, and Damon Young, author of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. Dream, Soraya, Damon, thanks to all of you for coming on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, Soraya, let's start with you. And let's start with the interview by Gail King. How do you think she handled the question regarding Kobe's assault charge?
So I thought it was extremely professional. Like, this is not something that you can just sort of avoid. It's, you know, part of his life. It was actually a fairly major part of his life when it happened in 2003. And so I don't think it does anyone any favors to just sort of pretend like this incident, like, didn't exist. Especially considering the implications it had going forward in terms of the way that Bryant and his attorneys approached their legal strategy with the victim, which was basically to make her life as miserable as possible until she pretty much had no choice but to back out of testifying in a trial. So this idea, you know, when Gail is sort of pushing and she says, no, the charges weren't dropped, like it didn't go to trial, right? Like, it's not like he was acquitted. This was settled out of court after a fairly miserable time where the victim's name was outed. His attorneys, like, used it repeatedly, and her reputation was continually smeared. She was pretty much villainized in the media for months on end.
So, Dream, how do we make sense of this backlash specifically targeting Gail King?
Well, I think that Snoop was absolutely shameful in the way that he attacked Gail King, but it speaks to a larger trend that I've been noticing, mostly because I'm on the front end of it in some ways, after having made R. Kelly. I've definitely been receiving this kind of vitriol for more than a year. I actually reached out to Gail to just send her some love because I know what it feels like to have thousands of people online calling you all kinds of names. But there's a kind of getting information, and maybe Damon can speak to this more, but I've definitely been noticing that there's a strategy now. There seems to have been a line that was drawn in the sand, like, okay, we have Bill Cosby, you have R. Kelly, and we're drawing this line in the sand, like, no more. We're done with this conversation about accountability when it comes to Black men. Snoop behaved like a Neanderthal from my generation who is living in another century. I mean, he had to walk those comments back. He tried to really...
Yeah, he tried.
Yeah, half-heartedly. But I think that what Soraya talks about is, you know, really important. Like, Kobe had a pretty scandal-free life. There are very few things we know about Kobe. Kobe speaks Italian. Kobe is a phenomenal player whose game was arguably as elegant as Michael Jordan's, right? The one story that we have about Kobe and kind of the bits of gossip that come after that are the details. I think about Vanessa. I immediately thought about Vanessa when he died. Of course, we all did. We thought about her losing her husband and her daughter in one day and in one moment. It was incredibly awful. But I also immediately thought about this girl in Colorado and what that must have been like for her.
Damon, I'd like to bring you into this. There is this, I guess, question or statement rather that happens regardless of whether you're Black following any person's death, which is, it's too soon. Don't bring this up right now. How do we deal with that kind of defense or pushback?
Well, if now's too soon, then when is the right time? Because when Kobe was still playing, you know, then it was a distraction to bring it up then. And, you know, when after he had released a statement and, you know, had, you know, gone on with his life or whatever, it was, you know, too late to talk about it then. And so I think that if we're talking about a person's life, like a person's legacy, and both Dream and Soraya alluded to this, that's a part of it. What he was accused of is a part of his footprint. And we can't delete that. We can't erase that. And, you know, there's a difference between, okay, Kobe Bryant just retired, and we're talking about his basketball on-court legacy. But if we're talking about a person dying and we're talking about their life and everything he did off the court, also all the girl dad stuff, all the WNBA supporting allyship stuff, then we have to talk about the accusation too. We have to talk about 2003. We have to talk about the fact that he started calling himself the Black Mamba directly after that and try to unpack and deconstruct what does that mean? You know, because, again, this is all, it's all a part of it. And it's not like Gail was outside of the funeral or outside of, mm-hmm. like, one of the memorials at the Staples Center, you know, putting microphones in people's faces and asking them about this. I mean, you do an interview with Gail King, you know, you should know that she's going to do her job. And again, you know, one of the most disappointing parts of all of this is that in a week of Kobe's death, We had so many Black men showing so much vulnerability and grief and publicly exposing themselves and crying and doing all of this, and that was beautiful, you know. And then the girl dad stuff followed it, and so we have this opportunity to be vulnerable, to have people give us empathy, to have space and to create space and to make space for that empathy, for that vulnerability. And I feel like all it would take is like a slight pivot to, well, you know what? We also need to talk about this other thing. We also need to extend this empathy for people who maybe don't feel the same way about Kobe that we do.
Soraya, Damon brought up all these Black men. Snoop Dogg is sort of the face and the voice of this kind of anger. But you're also getting a lot of anger from Black women as well, correct?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's, I think, a spectrum of opinions about this. You know, I had someone online yesterday call me the C word because I basically, there's this false argument that the Black men who have been accused of sexual abuse have faced consequences that their white counterparts have not.
Meanwhile, Harvey Weinstein is on trial right now in New York, right? Charlie Rose has lost his job. Matt Lauer has lost his job. So, I mean, there have been overwhelming consequences for these men, and that's been a bit of a canard.
That the canard that it's only black men who are getting all the attention.
Mm-hmm. Right, and who are being targeted or who are facing professional ramifications. That's simply not true. And I want to say, I think, like, one of the things that makes it quite difficult and sort of complicated when we're thinking about Kobe in particular is the fact that his entire sort of persona post-2003 that he created deliberately, right, with this Black Mamba nickname, was all about sort of embracing anti-heroes and the sort of dark side of himself, right? Mm-hmm. I think one of the people that he name-checked was Darth Vader. And that directly stemmed from what happened in Colorado, mm-hmm. And his decision to basically be like, "Okay, I'm going to take on this persona as the quote unquote bad guy."
Dream. Oprah has also been caught in the middle of a similar backlash this year, first producing a documentary about the women who accused Russell Simmons of sexual assault, and then for taking her name off the project. As a filmmaker, what do you make of that situation?
Well, I think that this is a part of this new landscape that I'm describing. I mean, when Soroya talks about this fact-free argument, and I say that fully aware that we're in this Trumpian, like, fact-free landscape where data doesn't matter, where the New York Times can publish an article that says, here are the 201 men who have lost their jobs or livelihood or have otherwise faced criminal charges even to the Me Too movement. Maybe one of them was black. Maybe one of them was Indian. I'm not sure. But the majority of them were white men, including, as Soroya said, some of our favorite names, an NPR host, Mario Batali. I mean, people have gone down behind this. Yeah. And we can talk about a handful of black men, and that becomes outsized if you live in your bubble where your Instagram feed is constantly, and I'm saying Bill Cosby, I don't want to invoke his name a bunch of times. Snoop did, right? Mm-hmm. And so when Bill Cosby and R. Kelly, which are basically, you know, one of two men, I mean, two men who may be facing some charges, it just becomes this outsized argument that's not based in fact. So Russell Simmons, I mean, I thought that Oprah handled that clumsily. It cast all kinds of aspersion on the actual testimonies of these women. I know Drew Dixon well. I saw the film at Sundance. The film is really good. It's going to find its home. There are more than 20 women who've accused Russell Simmons. And I think that what we're talking about is a flanking. You know, the reason that black women are coming for Soroya is because, first of all, the person who stands in front of this, the person that is getting the love and protection in this moment is, you know, Lisa Leslie. It's like, here's how to be a good and loyal race woman in this moment. Here's how to be respectful. Like, you know, I think Snoop shouted Lisa Leslie out. And here's an example of how not to act. So when you see 50 Cent, you know, coming for Oprah, and Drew Dixon talked about, like, wow, if the most powerful woman, black woman in the world, can be bowed to 50 Cent then and Russell Simmons, then we're in trouble. And of course, Oprah came out and said that's not at all what happened. But I mean, there are all kinds of things that are happening that only black people can see, quite frankly. I mean, Russell Simmons has been wearing a bow tie for 3 years. We remember when Farrakhan came to the defense of people like Mike Tyson and Bill Cosby. And so all of these things are happening, some that are quite visible, some that only black people are seeing and knowing. And I, too, want to push some kind of pause button and have these conversations in safer spaces. But this is where they're happening.
Damon, after Kobe's death, you wrote a piece for Very Smart Brothers that did mention the rape allegation. Just wondering, did you personally wrestle with whether to bring it up in the days after his death?
I wrestled with how to. Mm. I like, you know, in terms of how to structure the piece, mm-hmm. and how to write about it. But what to include in the piece wasn't a hard decision, mm-hmm. For me to make.
As a guy who wrote that piece, did you also receive a lot of backlash?
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, you write things on the internet and people are going to get upset about it. And that's, you know, that's par for the course. And now, obviously, the level of vitriol that I receive is going to be different than what someone like Soraya or Dream or Gayle King or you know, Jemele Hill also is someone who gets a lot of criticism and threats and things of that nature. And so there's a privilege there also where I know that if I say a thing, people are going to be upset or whatever, but they're not going to respond in the same way to me that they would to a black woman writing this and writing something like that. And that actually brings me back to a point that both Dream and Soraya are kind of alluding to and mentioned kind of explicitly too, is that, okay, so Snoop and 50 Cent, you know, have accused Gayle and Gayle King and Oprah of being anti-black. And Snoop has been anti-black his entire career. And the thing is, we look at, you know, his misogyny and try to kind of parse it out and separate it as like, okay, he just hates women with this music that he creates and the things that he says and the way he acts when he's not in the studio. But throughout, I mean, Snoop has been a public figure for almost 30 years now. Mm. And the only woman that I ever seen him respect on any level is Martha Stewart. Hmm. You know, he has been, you know, and so if you are anti-black women in your music, then you are anti-black. And he's been that, well, yeah. You know, and again, that's like the irony. That's one of the ironies here is like these men who are getting on these platforms and accusing these women of being anti-black and not protecting them and not protecting black men have entire careers of anti-blackness, of very racially problematic stuff that they've done, that they've made money, that they become multimillionaires off of.
So, Ryan, is there any way that the black community can reckon with the black journalist doing his or her job without getting dragged or being labeled a traitor?
Oof. It's difficult because part of what also makes this so complicated is that, you know, for a long time, journalism as an industry has not necessarily been fair in its coverage of black people, right? I mean, if you go back to when Ida B. Wells started covering lynchings, at one point, the New York Times actually labels her as like a slanderous and dirty-minded mulattress.
Yeah.
Because she's talking about these extrajudicial killings. And so there is like well-founded skepticism when it comes to black people and how we view white media. And so like that's something that we have to reckon with. I think that's something that newsrooms have to reckon with in terms of like we have a credibility problem that we need to own up to and do as best we can to repair that.
Soraya Nadia McDonald is a culture critic for ESPN's The Undefeated. Dream Hampton is a filmmaker and activist. And Damon Young is the author of What Doesn't Kill You Makes You Blacker. Thank you all so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Venugopal, and this is The Takeaway.